of God and annulment from the church. To read the letters of that religious to her mother. You've taught us everything that we believe. How can you do this to us? And her six children are automatically declared illegitimate. So don't tell me this is just theology. This is down to earth. Bishops, pray. I beg of you, pray for bishops. That they might keep the faith, especially in their obedience to the Holy See. Behind the disaggregation of women's communities, men's communities too, but especially the women's, are bishops who have allowed them to do everything under the sun, including marry off their priests. As the Bishop of Rockford recently remarked, four nuns living in an apartment cost me four priests. That's what we're talking about. This is not theory. It's not in my notes, by the way. So, at the most emphatic insistence, this, the ex cathedra, extraordinary teaching of the church, is only the fourth and the least in terms of frequency or importance of the church's teaching. Take the Council of Trent, must have 200 definitions. Never as such taught by the Pope, but taught by the Council and approved by the Pope. Everyone is infallible, including what I've just said, the indissolubility of marriage. Brother Ephraim. Well, they are all infallible in their way. In other words, practically everything of the Second Vatican Council is teaching that is already is part of the Church's ordinary magisterium. So in terms of infallibility, objective infallibility, it was there before the council met. Then, for many things, especially the decrees of the Second Vatican Council, they were left open, and the Pope insisted they be kept open until he then, with his supreme authority, refined and clarified the legislation. And then, once he did so, then the document, or that part of the document which he so taught, take for example, the Second Vatican Council recommended that, see, the sacrament of confirmation, the ritual be revised. Well, we don't precisely speak of a recommendation being an infallible teaching, right? It is approved. But then, the moment the Pope stepped in and did what he himself reserved to himself to revise, once he made the revision, that revision becomes infallible. So there are two kinds of infallibility built into the Second Vatican Council. The prior infallibility which is part of the Church's ordinary universal magisterium, and that is most of the 16 documents are that. Or, second, subsequent to the Council, through the by now scores of post-conciliar documents which the Pope has issued based on and in the light of the Second Vatican Council, which then taught to the Universal Church, become infallible teaching. Okay. Any other questions?
We can't always tell where the reforms of Vatican II are and where innovative interpretations are being made. For example, there are some people who cannot accept the meaning in the hand. There are some people who don't accept the fact we have girl altar boys, and then we had one priest, of course, who got married. Now, this is kind of a wide range. The fact that a priest wants to get married, this can be seen clearly as a problem, but what about all the other things? How can we...
Well, take communion of the hand. Communion of the hand was never positively willed by Pope Paul. In one country after another, people took the liberty, generally religious, took the liberty, of course, with the, you might say, connivance of the priests, to give communion of the hand. In France, I'm told, back in the 60s. Finally, one hierarch after another requested of the Pope, as a concession, to allow communion of the hand. Every document of the Holy See on communion of the hand indicates it's a concession. It is not the preferred way which the Pope wants it. I might say, well, why did he allow it? That's a larger question than I can answer. All I know is that when, at the second to the last vote in the United States, when Cardinal Codbury was still the vice president of the National Conference of Bishops, I was asked by the Conference of Bishops to present a case in favor of communion on the tongue. And in fact, it was then voted overwhelmingly to remain as it was. And among many things I found in the documentation that I presented to the bishops was that it's not even certain in the early centuries whether communion in the hand was the common practice. Even that is not certain. What is certain is that by the 8th and 9th centuries, communion of the hand was discontinued because of the widespread profanation. That's certain. And as I wrote in my brief for the bishops, all that I know of our United States does not give me comfort that the people will be all that respectful. If there were problems in the 8th and 9th century, I predict problems in the 20th century. And, as you know, the vote was lost. In other words, they didn't quite get enough. Then, contrary to all protocol, they went in search of the absentee bishops, the bishops who were sick in bed, to get just enough votes to have the Pope give the concession. In fact, the history of the 20th century cannot be written for another 100 years of just what the pressures in the church have done to the church. On this subject, in which I am not uninformed, I could give a whole 2-semester course on pressures in the church and what they have done. Who asked the question? Okay. Now, regarding the marriage of priests, that is, those who had taken solemn vows of celibacy and were laicized, the main reason, again, they were terrific pressures. The main reason was 2 world wars. The first, and especially the second. When countries like France, priests were conscripted by law, not as chaplains, but as soldiers. In the United States, a seminary, for example, religious, and a priest, is exempt from military service. Not everywhere. After the Second World War, there were thousands of priests through those, because the First and Second World War really were not even separated. They were constant. You know, many in service. Germany, France, Italy. Heavily Catholic countries. There were thousands of priests who by then had children out of wedlock. And that's the mildest statement you can make. So that Pope Pius XII was faced with the terrible dilemma of what to do with these men. He was the one who first opened up what we now call laicization, or the dispensation from celibacy. He was unknown before Pius XII for about 900 years. We were told in theology there was not a single record of a public dispensation from the solemn vow of celibacy for a priest in some 9 centuries. So that's a good question, you see. But what's happened, well, priests are now questioning whether they should even be celibate. What was a concession to a terrible condition in the church? To solve that, others then picked up and, well, have developed it to a point where we'd hardly recognize the original genesis of it. The problems facing the church, and of course it's not just that, now it's a question of invalid ordinations. This is the problem that Rome is facing now. Where I gave an ordination to Pete, this diocese is unnamed, and did I tell you about this? Where the night before the ordination to the diaconate, where they would take their vows of celibacy, 2 men came to me and asked me, I had just finished their retreat, and asked if they could be ordained conditionally. What do you mean, conditionally? Well, if in 5 years the Catholic Church removes the obligation of celibacy, then we will be ordained, then we want to be ordained. If in 5 years the Church does not remove the celibacy, then, though we will go through the ceremony, we withhold intention. second thief and got me out of bed. It was around midnight. Well, I did everything that... what could I do? Pleaded with them, urged. But they are free agents, right? And it's for these reasons that we've got to make sure we know what the church's official teaching is, because you're right. So much of what we are being subjected to today is not the church's teaching. Well, there may be churchmen and even church leaders that are saying or doing things. I'm involved with a Loyola series for teaching of religion for the grammar schools. And Loyola Press just received, and I got a copy of the critique by a Midwestern diocese, in which among the points of criticism officially approved by the Board of Education of that diocese was that this series shows a remarkable unawareness of development in Christology. Well, that can mean a lot of things. For example, in this series it says that Jesus is God. Do you hear that? Do you hear that? And I'm being recorded? Yes. Yes. My plea with people is to wake up to what's happening. You either know your faith thoroughly and you're closely united with God in prayer, or you will lose it. That's a universal statement. Today, no one keeps the faith unless, according to their capacity, they understand it and are men and women of prayer. Thanks for those questions. Sister? None. Same word. Same concept, but two different terms. Please? Oh, there have been 21. There have been 21 general councils of the Catholic Church. There have been 21 general councils. 21 ecumenical, 21 general. Substitute the word general for ecumenical, you've got the same thing. In Catholic theology, since the Protestants picked up the word ecumenical, and only the Lord knows all the meanings they attach to that word, means everything under the sun. Catholic theologians, me included, have decided, lest we muddy the waters still more by putting in ecumenical, what we don't need is more confusion. So we're now calling them general councils. Now the scope of the church's teaching. Suppose we go till 2 o'clock and then take about a 10 or so minute break, okay? Between this course and the other one. What is the scope of the church's teaching? What are we asking? We are asking, what can and even must the church teach? As the one appointed by Christ to bring the world to salvation. I have by now, in different courses that I teach, somewhat touching on this subject, come up with a dozen formulas. My latest is this, and I share it with you. The scope of the teaching can be divided into three categories. First, The church may and does teach divine revelation. What do you mean the church teaches divine revelation? Isn't that something that God reveals? It sure is. But what good is it for God to reveal something unless people know that He revealed it? Consequently, under revelation there are two. First, the church is authorized, divinely authorized, to teach what is revelation, to identify revelation. If I were to ask somebody, has it been revealed by God that there are three persons in God? Somebody. Been revealed? Okay. How do we know? Because the church teaches it. As revealed. Okay. How do we know there are four Gospels? There were 25 when our four were first written. Because the church identified only those four are good Gospels. Otherwise known, remember, as canonical. Otherwise known as inspired. Remember? So identified. When Pope Pius XII defined Mary's assumption, he further defined that it is revealed. Revealed where? It's not in the Bible, that's for sure. So the church said it's revealed in tradition. The Protestants, long before the definition came, I did tell you, didn't I, that I gave a series of lectures, didn't I? Yes. Months before, I had been working with the Vatican Radio at the time, and I was asked by the Holy See to give a series of lectures over the Vatican Radio, beamed especially to England and the English-speaking world, defending the Pope's right to define what is not in the Bible. Because the Catholic Church is not the Protestant Church. So what's new? So the first role of the Church as teacher of mankind is to teach what is revelation. To tell us what books belong to the Bible, that's identifying revelation, right? Take, for example, To this day, Mark's Gospel, the last 12 verses of Mark's Gospel are generally missing from most Protestant Bibles. If I tell you about the Gideon Bible now, most encouraging. They're catching up. Are those 12 verses revealed? The church says they are. So it's down to the smallest doctrine. Or a whole collection of doctrines like in the book of a Bible, right? The church's first and most important, you might say, role as teacher is to identify revelation. The church told us that the Gospel of John was revealed by the Holy Spirit, would we know? I know of no scholarly, Protestant theologian who accepts the Gospel of John as inspired. Not one. They all believe it's a second, even late second century production. And the New American Bible, with its copious notes, has gone through a number of revisions because some of the very learned exegetes who wrote the footnotes and the introductions to the various books of the Bible will have to be corrected. So that's the first. The church says what is revealed, and we better know. Secondly, the church explains Revelation. This is not an elaborate theological analysis, just the bare explanation. For example, are the words of our Lord at the Last Supper, "This is my body, this is my blood," are to be taken literally? That's pretty important. Or that when Christ rose from the dead, that his resurrection was a real bodily resurrection. That's a pretty important explanation. So much for that. A large and most important area of the church's teaching. Second, the premises of Revelation. By premises, I mean the grounds of Revelation, the basis of Revelation, the presuppositions of Revelation. And these can take three forms. In the scope of teaching, anything you can ever find that the church teaches is somehow here. First, principles of philosophy. Can the church teach principles of philosophy? By the principle of causality. Or the idea that every created substance, every created being has substance and accidents. Yes, Hashi, she sure has. And people who have trouble with transubstantiation say that it's tied into a philosophy. Well, my dear, exegetes. So what? The Church of God has authority over philosophy too. Because what good would it be for the Church to say that Christ is really present in the Blessed Sacrament? What do you mean, really present? We know he's really present. Well, I know, but what do you mean? Well, does it mean that after the consecration, the bread and wine are no longer there? They seem to be there because it looks like bread, tastes like bread, and the same with wine. What do you mean he's really present? Is the bread gone? Is the wine gone? Is that which makes bread bread and wine wine, is that gone after transubstantiation? Let me ask this question. After consecration, is that which makes bread bread, its breadness, or wine wine, its wineness? Is that gone the moment transubstantiation takes place?
External.
Sister Rita Rose, please.
External.
Yeah. Sister Rita Rose, one person, please.
The substance is not there, but what we see.
Well, now, what is the substance? The substance of wine is its wineness. Of bread is breadness. All right. Now, you don't say those things unless you've got some philosophical explanation. So, the church, sure, the church coined the term transubstantiation to declare simultaneously two things: the real presence, that Christ is there, and the bread and wine are not there. You mean the bread and wine are not there? I can see them. My dear unenlightened Catholic, they're not there. Okay? That's what transubstantiation means. And that's why, as I go over And people who had been, you know, the Catholic boys and girls of 20, 30 years ago, who are now peddling the most awful theology. Much of it, I think, was due to their faulty training. Not only because other factors have entered.
In other words, the bread and the wine, their substance. In other words, you have Jesus Christ. There was a change of what had been this, it becomes that.
You have left only the external properties. But then, you, for example, somebody would say, as way back in the Middle Ages, some heretics were saying, but you cannot have the physical properties of anything without the thing being there. Naturally, no. You mean, this is what John Wycliffe, a priest, a heretic in the Middle Ages, do you mean that I see bread and wine, but bread and wine are not there. I just have the appearances, just the external quality. That's right. So, first, philosophical principles. The church better have control. She can teach, and she does teach infallibly, principles of philosophy, like substance here and accident, right? You can't speak three sentences explaining the real presence without coming down to grips with this business of substance and accident. Right? Secondly, historical facts. Does the church have a right to teach that certain facts actually took place? Yes. Suppose somebody, well, Archbishop Lefebvre did question, you know, the validity of the election of Pope Paul, all kinds of bizarre ideas. Now, suppose somebody were to question the validity of an election of the Pope. Would just come up in different parts, different times of the church's history. Could a pope solemnly define that I've been validly elected? Could he? Yeah. He better be able to. Take, for example, when the church condemned Jansenism. The Pope infallibly defined that the book that Jansenius wrote was written precisely in the sense in which his predecessor had condemned it. Because the Jansenists said, Your Holiness, what terrible doctrine these Jansenists teach. But we don't find those doctrines in our founder. So he had to come along and declare infallibly that the doctrines that were condemned were historically written in this book. And even went to the length of saying, and they were written in the sense in which my predecessor condemned them. And nobody was inside of Jansenius' mind when he wrote that book. Can the church define some fact? Could the church now define? She has not yet. Now that's the third thing. Empirical data. Empirical data. When, may I ask, is the human soul infused into the body? Let me give you three possibilities. Well, let me give you four. At birth. How many buy that? Second, at what is called animation. It's about after 3 months. At conception. I've got one more. fertilization.
Yes. Yes.
In other words, what's the difference? Any nurses in the... Are there any nurses in the... Oh, you're going to see in the crowd. Pardon me. Pat? Between conception and fertilization, how would you, in your own words, describe the difference between the two?
I couldn't.
Well, conception is the usual term we use for the time when a child is conceived, right? But do we specify when we say, suppose we said, as many of you did say, that the soul is infused at conception. Well, that's like saying the soul is infused when it's infused. Thanks. When is it infused? What's the answer? Fertilization. Well, except that the fertilization, as you know, there are all kinds of stages, right? From the moment of fertilization to the maturation, up to the point when it becomes what is attached to the inside of the uterus, the so-called nidation. Pat, about how much time can elapse from...
That's been too long since I studied obstetrics.
Well, I teach my students about 12, up to 12 days. In any case, the church has never defined, notice what we're saying, she has never defined that conception or the infusion of the whole human soul takes place at fertilization. But she thus, in practice, acts. All right? So, since I have no difficulty, since the church in practice acts as if or as though there already was a soul there after fertilization, then it means that she assumes that it's there. Now, she may come along and professedly teach this and even define it. In fact, she does teach it. The document of Pius XII, by the way, is quoted, I believe, the document just came out before the catechism went to press. So I've got the quotation there in which he says, at the time when the ovum is fertilized, already a human soul is infused. That's pretty important. Because many of the drugs that women are taking now, they either prevent conception in the first place, or they destroy whatever is the first result of the fertilization, which then by Catholic standards is already abortion. Okay? Now let me finish, let me take a few more minutes to finish this up so we don't have any unfinished business. Consequences of revelation. They are of two kinds. First, the logical conclusions. Certain things which the church recognizes as being revealed, she then, or her scholars and thinkers, reasoning, reflecting on that revealed deposit of faith, come up with some rather extraordinary conclusions. Provided, watch this, provided the logic is correct, the conclusions drawn from revelation can be taught by the church no less infallibly than the revelation itself. Now this, as you gather, is saying a lot, because a great deal of the church's teaching is not precisely revealed. So as not only, notice what we're saying, It is not only that in the Catholic Church we hold that not all of Revelation is in the Bible. That's already a lot more than is in the Scriptures. But look how far we've gone. The Church, starting with something which is either in the Bible or tradition, through centuries of reflection, can reach a conclusion. And that conclusion she can teach and bind the consciences of all the faithful to believe. Now, this, for example, would be the case in the canonization of saints. All the saints, certainly those that have been canonized in the last 900 or so years since canonization processes have been in the Church, all these people lived centuries after Revelation was closed. How does the Church reason? Very simply.
1, 2, 3. Do we have in Revelation the norms of sanctity? So, N of S. What is a nice, simple collection of the norms of sanctity in the New Testament?
Beatitudes.
Nice guy.
The Church wants to canonize, say, like Elizabeth Seton. So Elizabeth Seton is equal to a saint. Norms for becoming a saint, let's call it. Okay? To reach this conclusion that Elizabeth Seton was a saint, the Church starts with Revelation. Then she does what? Studies the life of Elizabeth Seton. And after thoroughly studying, in other words, this is study. She concludes, this woman, known as Elizabeth Seton, was a saint. Why? Because the norms are revealed. This conclusion the Church has defined. Every canonization of every saint is an infallible definition of the Church. I wish all of our diocesan writers for diocesan papers recognize that. You know whether you should laugh or scream or cry or just get sick when you read some of the stuff published in Catholic papers. You just hope now. One pastor tells me I will not identify the diocese. It's required in that diocese that all parishioners subscribe to the diocesan paper. So he sends it in his bill every year, checked, sent in faithfully. I've been informed on good authority, soon as the bundle comes in, it's a large parish, 3,000 or so. He has an incinerator. He takes one copy for his records. He burns all the rest. And I would say, God be praised. But isn't it sad to have to say this? That's why I started at 5:50 last evening to get here to teach. I know what's going on. Either you know your faith and through your prayer keep it, or you can't. Too many pressures. So that's the first. The logical conclusions. Secondly, practical application. Now, if the number of logical conclusions is in the thousands, the number of practical applications is in the tens of thousands, I wonder, this would really make my day, which has been, I can't describe it. What one practical application of the church's teaching on religious life has created so much confusion, and which it seems clear our present Holy Father is going to keep insisting and insisting that religious obey.
Bring the
habit. Ah, my day is made. That